This week, silver blasted higher to within earshot of $20 an ounce, while the Dow Jones Industrial Shares Index added about 100 points. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczek. It's a pleasure to be with you this weekend. The U.S. jobless number came in lower than expected, which put downward pressure on Fed funds futures, encouraging precious metals purchases. Joining me this week with their take on the sector and just what it will mean for your portfolio, two more top industry insiders, including John Embree, senior strategist at Sprott Asset Management, returns with his insights. He says the recent pullback represents a discounted buying opportunity, and that's exactly what we saw happen this week, with the metals roaring back on disappointing jobs numbers. Once gold breaks free of the current consolidation, the bull market will move higher, he says, and China's official 3,000-ton gold reserve number is likely very lowball. They probably have most of the world's gold stored in various places, including their proprietary banking system. Then, senior research fellow Dr. Paul Craig Roberts rejoins the show. He says the bullion banks may have an infinite stockpile of naked gold shorts, but that just stopped working in 2016, plus an underground international bank transaction clearing system could jeopardize U.S. dollar hegemony, making the precious metals even more attractive. He is bracing his readership for what could be the deepest depression in national history. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector this week, despite dollar strength and hawkish comments from the Fed policymakers. Silver and gold moved higher. By Friday's close, the yellow metal added about just under a dollar, ending at $13.26. Silver added 62 cents, closing just shy of $19.50 an ounce, up about 3% and wiping away all of last week's decline. The precious metals XAU shares finished up 84 cents, about 1%, at $96.63, while West Texas Intermediate crude bucked the trend, dropping $3.20 to just above $44.44 per barrel. That's off about 6%, but black gold still looks to be building a very solid inverted head and shoulders pattern, along with the CRB index, finding support more than likely soon and hopefully blasting up to 70, even 100 per barrel in the next 12 to 24 months. Meanwhile, the top story moving the markets came from a Labor Department report on Friday, which indicated the employment data missed estimates, boosting the metals appeal as a safe haven. Payrolls climbed by 151,000 last month. That was off significantly from the expected $260,000 number and following the $275,000 gain in July. The unemployment rate, though, stayed steady at 4.9%. But now that the economy is clearly at or near full employment, many economists are expecting unemployment to inch higher, due in no small part to the slowdown in manufacturing and global economic growth. Plus, amid the strong U.S. dollar, that makes our goods a little bit less competitive against other currencies, and so the Fed really risks an unemployment spike should they raise rates much higher. That's why I believe their hands are tied until next year following the presidential election. Nevertheless, on a positive note, there was considerable job growth in the financial services, healthcare, and food industries, which all experienced double-digit gains. Gold is higher by 25% this year. Amid uncertainty in U.S. growth, the Fed fund futures odds drop sharply, not until February of next year do traders now expect a rate hike. That shift in sentiment just over the last week or two is certainly a big positive for the precious metals, because low rates ensures that negative real rates of return. That's the ideal environment for gold and silver profits. Bottom line on the precious metals: well, despite continued hawkish jawboning from Fed officials, investors simply continue to ignore the nonsense and focus instead on reality. The U.S. dollar is in dire condition. It has not rallied significantly in about 2 years and appears to be building a massive head and shoulders pattern, which could lead to the next leg lower in its bear market and might explain the surprising resiliency recently in the precious metals. Plus, we have favorable holiday gift-related and seasonal patterns which support higher precious metals on a forward basis. Moving on to the Wall Street report, mostly sunny weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on news that the unemployment rate held firm at 4.9%. August is traditionally one of the, if not the worst months for the Labor Department figures. The Dow Jones Industrials added about 97 points for the week, finishing at 18,491, up about 0.5%, while the S&P 500 added 11 points, also up 0.5% at 2180 for the week, while the NASDAQ picked up about 31 points, also about 0.5%, finishing at 5250. Clearly, the top story moving the shares market this week was the non-farm payrolls number, which fell to 151,000 last month. Financial stocks have rallied in recent weeks on anticipation of higher rates. Bottom line on Wall Street, well, the fear-greed index moved into neutral territory. Much of the excesses appear to have been wrung out of the market. However, the VIX volatility index is nearing unprecedentedly low levels. As long as we hold this week's lows, new record highs are anticipated in the Dow and the S&P 500 in the coming weeks. And Goldseek Radio is excited to have a new assistant here on the show, Alexa from Amazon.com. Alexa, hello.
Hi there.
Alexa, how are you?
I'm good. I hope you're doing well, too.
Alexa, what time is it?
The time is 7:19 p.m.
Alexa, what's the weather?
Currently, in Glenville, it's 64 degrees with cloudy skies.
Alexa, play Havana Affair by the Ramones.
Havana Affair by Ramones from Prime Music.
Alexa, who made you?
A team of inventors at Amazon.
Alexa, Wiki Gettysburg Address.
The Gettysburg Address is a speech by U.S. President Abraham Lincoln, one of the best known in American history.
Alexa, how far is Jupiter?
Jupiter's distance is 594 million miles.
Alexa, what is the atomic weight of uranium?
Uranium's atomic weight is 238.03.
Alexa, how far is the moon?
The moon's distance is 239,000 miles, 384,000 kilometers.
Alexa, timer, 62 minutes.
1 hour and 2 minutes, starting now.
Alexa, alarm, 6 a.m.
Second alarm set for 6 a.m. tomorrow.
Alexa, traffic report.
The fastest route takes about 3 hours.
Alexa, you're the best.
Thanks so much.
So as everyone can see, Alexa is an interface to the computer world as well as the information highway that requires no keyboard and virtually no experience whatsoever. Our three-year-old is already asking Alexa to play the Gummy Bears song. Here's a little taste of what we've enjoyed. Alexa, play Gummy Bears.
Here's a sample of Gummy Bear by Peanut Butter Jelly Time DJs.
Coming up after the break, more Goldseek.com radio with our two big guests and Robert Ian. Pleasure to welcome back Dr. Paul Craig Roberts to the show, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury of Economic Policy during the Reagan administration and a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week. Welcome back, Dr. Roberts.
Hello, Chris.
Your website is filled with topicality. At least one that caught my attention was another phony jobs report that you penned recently. You also follow another guest of the show, Mr. John Williams of Shadow Stats. An interesting metric that I don't think the mainstream really picked up on. 200,000 jobs that we gained might be not quite as solid as our officials or our policymakers would have us think. You say that this might just be an assumption made by the birth-death model, you refer to it. More hedonic nonsense, smoke and mirrors.
Yes, back during the Reagan years, the first term of Reagan, when the everybody was ganging up on Reagan and on supply side economics, and so when the policies finally got partially implemented, you know, they were delayed a couple of years before they went into effect. The economy quickly recovered, and there was a big increase in jobs. Only the Bureau of Labor Statistics missed it and said, oh, there's no jobs, no, it's not working. Because they missed the increase in jobs and were subsequently embarrassed by this, they invented what they call the birth-death model. By birth and death, they're talking about the creation of new businesses that have not yet reported the payroll employment to BLS, businesses that have failed and gone out of business and have not reported the job losses. And their model assumes a rising economy, not a flat or declining economy. And in the rising economy, they made an assumption that there were so many new jobs created every month because the creation of new jobs that were unreported exceeded the failed companies whose job loss was not reported. And so this sort of model doesn't work in the type of economy we've had in the 21st century. And so all the jobs they're reporting are really a product of this add-on factor in that model. And the rest of the jobs are a product of the games they play with seasonal adjustments. And John Williams is the one who has most explained this. And so when you see that we've had 250,000 jobs, most likely you haven't had any. And another reason that we can take confidence that we're not having these jobs is that the participation rate of the workforce has been falling year after year. And so that tells you that there are not employment opportunities, because historically, if the economy is growing and there are jobs available, the participation in the workforce rises. It doesn't shrink. And yet the participation rate has consistently fallen and is really at a extreme low. So these jobs are not real. And as I have reported, Chris, if you look at the location of these jobs, according to the BLS, they're all domestic service, lowly paid, part-time domestic service jobs, waitresses, bartenders, retail clerks, hospital orderlies. It's that type of thing. So, and this has been consistent for years. If you look at where they say the jobs are, you know, it's always waiters and bartenders and retail clerks. And this is the labor force of a third world country. This is not the labor force of an industrialized, manufacturing, first world economy. So what we see, even if these jobs were actually there, and it's a puzzle why so many waiters and bartenders, when discretionary income of people is not rising, and why so many new retail clerks when... So it really looks like the jobs are made up. But even if they aren't, it's not assuring. It's very disturbing, because it says that the economy can no longer create the kinds of jobs that pay enough that people can establish independent households. And, of course, another indication that these jobs are not there, or if they are, aren't any good, is the fact that, according to all the data, more than half of American 25-year-olds live at home with their parents. They can't get employment sufficient to move in with a girlfriend or have a roommate or even share rent on an independent existence. And then it turns out that more people aged 24 to 34 live at home with parents than they live independently. So you can see then that there's a collapse of income opportunity in the economy, and that the younger people joining the workforce simply don't have good prospects. So that, I think, sums up the true picture. There's simply not been a recovery. And what caused the destruction of job opportunity in the United States was the offshoring of American jobs. First, the offshoring of the manufacturing jobs, and then the offshoring of the tradable professional skill jobs, such as software engineering, research, design, that type of thing. Even architects, and now a lot of accounting work. As these jobs moved offshore, discretionary spending power of Americans declined, and the growth of American consumer income ceased. So there was nothing to drive the economy. And that's when Alan Greenspan launched the first of the Fed's big bubbles. He said, well, there's no income growth to drive the economy, and so what the Fed will do is supply an increase in consumer indebtedness in place of the missing growth in income. And by increasing their debt, consumers can spend more. And the easiest way to do that is to lower the interest rates, because that drives up housing prices, and then people can refinance their house with a higher mortgage. But since the interest rates are low, the payment doesn't grow, and they can take out the equity and spend it, and that will keep the economy going. So that was the Greenspan solution. And, of course, that works until people can't take on any more debt. It works until the real estate prices are a bubble. They're bid out of all proportion. And it works until all the financial institutions realize that in that type of atmosphere, they can commit massive fraud. And that's what the securitization of mortgages permitted them to do, because the people who made the loans no longer held the mortgages. So it didn't matter to them if the mortgages were sound or not, because they collected a fee for issuing a mortgage, and then they sold the mortgage, and then the mortgages were packaged and sold to investors. There was no connection between making a loan and the risk of the loan. So all those three things came into effect and bit hard, and we had the downturn. I think John Williams is correct that we have never come out of the downturn, and in fact, we may possibly be beginning to have a further downturn. So that is my summation of the situation.
I think it's an excellent summation, and I'm sure you've seen the numbers on Shadow Stats that if you adjust the GDP by a more appropriate inflation figure, deflator, if you will, we never emerged from the early 2000 recession. You could make the argument, at least according to his data there, that the GDP has remained in either close to negative territory or in negative territory for approximately 15 consecutive years. And it really corroborates, and I think underscores, the argument you've made here today. And I guess it shouldn't really be a surprise when 500,000 solid industrial-based jobs, manufacturing jobs, if you will, with perquisites, have just evaporated, been shipped offshore. But our listener base, they're familiar with that. They're very savvy. They might be wondering, is there a panacea that comes to mind?
Well, I don't know what panacea it would be. Essentially, what happened was when the Soviet Union collapsed, China and India, China was allegedly communist and India was socialist, and they did not have a positive attitude toward foreign capital coming into their country. So their large underutilized labor forces were not available to first world companies to move their production offshore where labor was cheaper and then pocket the difference as profits and managerial bonuses and capital gains for shareholders. So that option didn't exist until the Soviet Union collapsed and China and India adopted different policies. They came to the conclusion that they had to do more like the West because their system really didn't work. Look what happened to the Soviet Union. So once that started, firms who maybe were not doing so well said, look, we can boost our profits by making this stuff in China and bringing it back here to sell. So let's close down all the plants here and get this going. And it, once it got started, Wall Street, or what they're called shareholder advocates, they forced the remaining firms to do the same thing under threat of takeovers. Wall Street simply told the corporations, no matter how big they were, you know, multi-billion-dollar corporations, move offshore or we'll finance a takeover of the company because we want the higher profits that will come from the substantial drop in labor costs. What we have done is simply deindustrialize, the opposite of economic development. I don't know. One day I want to sit down and think up a term for the opposite of economic development. It's disdevelopment. So when you do that, look what you do. First of all, you deprive states and localities and federal government of tax base because all income, personal income, and as all the sales tax as well on the spending of consumers and so on, that's gone. So states and counties began having problems, and this meant also problems for their systems. And for some states, it meant problem for their municipal bond ratings. That sets in. And then also you start losing a skilled labor force. I mean, our skills are acquired through time and learned and passed on and relate to the process that's being used in the manufacturing. And so you lose that. And then you lose all the supply chains so that, you know, firms are not, they don't produce all their own inputs. You know, they buy things and they put them together and they make a product. And then you lose your supply chain. So even if you wanted to start making something, where are your suppliers? So it's very hard to recover from this. Moreover, you've given all of your technology to the other countries with the cheap labor. And so if you want to get going again, you've got to have tariffs to keep out their products because in the old days they could not outcompete you because they didn't have your technology. It's cheap labor. But your technology compensated for that, and so you were more productive even though they had cheap labor. But when they've got your technology, that's gone. That advantage is gone. And so you would have to have protected markets. And, of course, the World Trade Organization and so on, and all that prohibits tariffs. So how can you get it back? You know, you possibly could change the way you tax corporations. You could say if a corporation produces the goods and services offshore that it sells to Americans, we'll tax them at a higher rate, we tax their profits at a higher rate than if they produce the goods and services they sell to Americans here domestically. So possibly you could use this difference in the tax rate depending on the location where corporations add value to their products. If that happens domestically, a low tax rate. If it happens abroad, a high tax rate. You might be able to fix it that way. But you wouldn't be able to get it passed because the corporations are too powerful. They are one of the global corporations are one of the major interest groups that control the Senate, the House, the President, the regulatory agency. So they would simply say no. So it's not clear that you can recover. I mean, you can think up some scenarios. You could say, well, maybe a whole different kind of technology will come along and it'll be invented here that it'll be so different that none of the existing supply chains and skills are irrelevant, and that we'll just simply start all over on the basis of some new technology, you know, cold water fusion, or I mean, who knows what it could be, some new energy force. So you could say, yeah, that's possible. This would happen, and that when this came along, the leaders would see it was important to keep this here, and would take steps to prevent it being offshored as well. But that's about all I can think of, at least at this time.
I wonder if you could give our precious metals aficionados a ray of hope. You know, I mean, we obviously have seen an unusual situation, probably due at least in part to negative rates on both sides of the U.S. here. I mean, the BOJ and the European Central Bank in negative territory, at least on some of their sovereign debt. That, of course, has led to a stock market rally as funds flow in the United States. You know, bonds continue to do well, which is a little unusual to see them moving in tandem. And then the precious metals have had one of the best rallies in something like almost 30 years. Can you give us an idea of whether or not it would be a sound investment, a prudent decision to continue accumulating the precious metals, not just as a diversification method, perhaps even for, you know, improved expected returns and lower volatility?
First of all, let me say that I don't think any of the markets, neither stocks, bonds, real estate, or precious metals, are driven by fundamentals at this time, nor have they been, I think, for most of the 21st century. Certainly for the last 5 years, let's put it that way, or since the crash in December of 07, during this so-called period of recovery, fundamentals are not important. They have had no effect on anything. If fundamentals were operating with the enormous amount of buildup of debt at all levels, you know, public and private, individual, everybody's, corporate, federal, bond prices would be very low. The interest rates would be high just because the ratio of debt to GDP has risen so sharply that the risk of debt service would provoke higher interest rates. But we don't see that. Now, if we look at the stock market, very high stock market during this period, but it's not based on fundamentals. If you look at the P.E. ratios, they're very high historically. The period in which firms were making profits, it was largely due to the fact they were moving jobs offshore, and the lower labor costs were showing up as profits. And we look at the absence of growth in discretionary consumer income. We can't project profits from the future because there's no income growth of population. So we can't say that these P.E. ratios are profit-based. If we look at gold and silver prices, we would say, you know, they should be very, very high because the Federal Reserve has created so many new dollars that are not matched by growth in goods and services. The notion that the dollar still has the same value is unrealistic, and therefore the gold and silver prices should be reflecting the oversupply of dollars that the Fed created to essentially support the balance sheets of the banks too big to fail. So what is happening? What's driving the stock and bond prices up? And then we'll ask what's more or less had a lid on the gold and silver prices. Well, what's driven the stock and bond prices up is the extraordinary liquidity created by the Fed. It has to go somewhere. The Fed is putting it into bonds. This is, you know, this is what QE was all about. It was to create huge sums of money to support bond prices, which means to drive the interest rates down. So the explanation of the stock market and the bond market is the Fed liquidity. Can they quit? Apparently not. If they quit, then they've got the thing unraveling on them. So if we now look at gold and silver, what happens there? Well, Dave Kranzler and I published a number of articles proving beyond all doubt that the gold and silver prices were consistently driven down by the bullion banks, who are agents of the Federal Reserve, selling naked shorts in the futures market. In other words, they were shorting the market with uncovered shorts. In other words, since the price of gold and silver is determined in the futures market, which is a paper market, the bullion banks can print up an endless supply of paper gold in the form of futures contracts. So the supply of gold in the market where the price is determined was being printed up just like the supply of dollars was being printed up. So the bullion banks print up a bunch of shorts at some quiet time in the market. They dump massive amounts of shorts. This drives down the price. It sets off stop loss orders. It sets off margin calls. The price goes down further. The bullion banks then cover their shorts and pocket the difference. But the gold price has been taken way down dramatically. Had they begun doing this in earnest in the fall, I think, of 2011, and they've not stopped. Now, the rally that you call it this year, I mean, it's not a rally. It's simply been less naked short selling, or less often. And therefore, the real fundamentals in the market have been able to operate a little more. The real fundamentals is that the demand for gold and silver is high. Supply may be strained, and so the price should be rising. And so what has happened, and I don't know precisely the reason, though I think I have an idea, and I'll mention that. So what has happened is the bullion banks haven't been selling as many naked shorts on the COMEX, you know, in the middle of the night or sometime when there's no active trading or anything. So why haven't they? Well, this is speculation. And I think the answer may be that the West's ability to meet the strong Asian demand, the Chinese and Indian demand for bullion, is diminishing because the stocks of gold and silver in the West have been depleted in making these sales all during this period when the price is kept below the price it would be in a market that didn't have naked short selling. And so, by holding down the price, there's been a greater quantity of gold and silver demanded, and the supplies in the West are not what they were, and therefore it gets harder to use naked shorts to keep the price of bullion down. That's my take on it. I wouldn't bet my life on it, but that's the best answer I have to it.
What would be the implications, do you think, for the typical Westerner or American when the more realistic price for the yellow metal is reestablished and currencies are also adjusted to reflect their intrinsic value?
Well, the Fed rules the other central banks, and so if the Fed had to create trillions of new dollars, they have to protect the dollar's value, not just against gold, by having the market shorted, but against other currencies. And so they do the way they do that, they go to Japan, which has one of the other large currencies. They go to the euro, the European Central Bank, which has another of the large currencies, and they say, you two both have to do quantitative easing. And both central banks have been doing that now for some time. I think the Japanese rate of quantitative easing was even greater than the Fed's. And, of course, the European Central Bank has been doing quantitative easing and not long ago announced they were increasing the amount. And we have even the Bank of England doing quantitative easing. So you have the alternative currencies to the dollar, the yen, the euro, the pound, all printing madly as well. So if all the currencies are being printed, it's not possible for one to drop relative to the others, not in any meaningful sense. In other words, since the Japanese and Europeans and the British are printing money, they can't say, oh my gosh, look at all the money the Americans have printed. Currency traders can't say, well, you know, that much increase in supply, these other currencies aren't. There goes the dollar's exchange value. That doesn't happen if all the banks are printing. And once you start printing, it forces everybody. You may remember a few years ago, people trying to escape the dollar because of the money printing were flocking into the Swiss franc. It drove the Swiss franc up so high that the Swiss government announced that any further capital inflows into the country would be met with an increase in the supply of Swiss francs. In other words, they would simply print the money to stop the Swiss exchange rate from rising because they weren't able to sell anything. The currency was driven up so high. So everybody prints. So if everybody is printing, there's no reason for one currency to decline relative to the other, or no reason for one currency to rise relative to the other. So that situation is stable. And since most of the money printing has gone into asset inflation, stock and bond prices, certain kinds of real estate, and not into the economy, the governments have not had to worry about hyperinflation. Of course, our inflation is higher than they admit, but it's not unlivable yet. So as long as this money creation goes into financial assets, it can continue. And that's why people are still in the stock market, because the Fed is driving it up by printing money. Now, at some point, you say, how can it go into bonds when there's a zero interest rate? I mean, nobody wants to buy a bond and get back less than you bought. And this has happened with Treasury bills and a few other instruments, but it appears to be because the purchasers don't trust the banks. And so they'll pay a premium to be in Treasury bills. But there's a limit to that. If the interest rates can't get too negative, if the liquidity that's been going into bonds really can't go there anymore, where does it go? Well, probably stocks. So we could have even more unrealistic P.E. ratios. It would be going into gold and silver, except we have the bullion banks able to sell naked shorts in vast quantities and drive down the price. So if something happens that means the West can't meet Asian demand for gold, so they can't drive down the gold price with naked shorts, the liquidity can go into gold and up can go the gold price. In fact, it could be the liquidity driving up the gold price much more than the fear of investors of the dollar. So these things we just don't know. My own view, and this comes from not having expected this house of cards to stand this long. It's been a stronger house of cards than anybody would think who looks at it on the basis of fundamentals, but you can't look at it on the basis of fundamentals. You have to look at it as a rigged system maintained by the Fed and the other central banks, in which fundamentals play almost no role. So what could happen? Well, if something were to happen to the dollar, the Fed would have to choose between the banks too big to fail and the dollar. And since the power of the United States government is based on the dollar, the Fed would have to say, save the dollar, let the banks go. And to save the dollar, they would have to be able to attract foreign investment, foreign currencies, foreigners who want to be in dollar-denominated assets. And so the interest rates would have to go up. Well, when that happens, a lot of debt relationships are going to unwind, and you're probably going to have an economic depression. Another thing that could set off the dollar, I don't know what would set that off. I mean, but that would be a consequence if something set it off. So what could set it off? Well, if somehow other countries have suffered enough from American financial imperialism, you know, like the French bank that had to pay $9 billion because it did business with some country that the Americans didn't approve of. And why did they have to pay that $9 billion? Because if they didn't, Washington told them, you'll be cut out of the American banking system. That means they can't settle international financial transactions. Well, this type of bullying, and that's just one example. That was the French bank. This type of bullying has happened all over a lot of people, and so there's now, it's more than rumor, I think, a new clearing system is being created. All the banks can clear directly with one another and not have to go through the American clearing mechanism. Well, if this gets up and running, then it means all these big banks no longer have any need for dollar reserves. That would mean the support for the dollar is gone. Now, whereas the Fed can print endless amount of dollars to support bond and stock prices, they can't print foreign currencies to support the dollar. So if there's this departure from the use of dollars and the use of the American clearing system for international transactions, Now we know the BRICS were already starting that, you know, and that the Russians and the Chinese have made various deals, and the other members of the BRICS have agreed to trade in their own currencies and not use a dollar clearing mechanism or not trade in dollars. But if this happens in a big way, for example, Japanese banks, British banks, European banks, the ability of the dollar to maintain its exchange rate is diminished, even if the other currencies are still being printed, because a huge chunk of demand for dollars is taken out, and therefore the only way you could maintain the dollar's exchange rate would be if the other currencies started printing even more in order to compensate for the drop in demand for dollars because people cease using American clearing system, which of course means they don't need dollar balances. So that is something that could happen. I think once it looks like the dollar is going to lose demand, given the huge supply of them out there, that the gold and silver price would go up very quickly. That's just the way it looks to me, because where would the money go? I don't think it can go into bonds any longer. The P.E. ratios of stocks are high. They all go higher, but at some point, people say, now, wait a minute. We've created trillions of new dollars, and now the demand for dollars has collapsed. Where does the money go? It could go into other currencies, but it could also go into gold and silver.
I wonder then if you would be an advocate of sound money and safe haven assets for the typical investor, given your concern about the retirement issues.
It's hard to advise people when there are no longer any rules. You know, what is sound money? Well, if we say it's gold and silver, well, but it can be confiscated. I mean, remember, they confiscated, FDR confiscated gold before. When I was coming along, we still had silver coins, and there were treasury notes that could be redeemed for silver, and they took that away. So I don't really know what you do when there no rules. I think you have to do, everybody has to make up their own mind. And certainly gold and silver would have far more intrinsic value than pieces of currency, paper currency. And they've always been the world's money in history. And so if you debauch a currency, a paper currency, then you need some kind of currency and to debauch. So they can be. You know, the Roman silver denarius was so debauched that it became almost solid lead. So you can have inflation even with when you have bullion currency. So, you know, there really aren't rules. And but I do think that the system is unstable. It's a house of cards. It can come unglued. And I think in the dollar, if the dollar becomes troubled, they won't be able to drive down gold and silver price by shorting the futures market. And as I said previously in this conversation, Chris, if they were not shorting gold and silver, which they have been doing consistently since the end of 2011, the gold and silver price would be far higher than they are right now.
And I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to navigate your browsers to the website and, of course, bookmark Paul Craig Roberts, that's all one word, .org, paulcraigroberts.org, especially the articles and columns section. I mean, this is a just important resource. Topicality is outstanding. Dr. Roberts, any parting comments or any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
No, that's fine. I appreciate your effort to try to keep people informed. They can't get very good information from the media or Wall Street or academic economists, or all of that is just part of the disinformation that they use to keep the house of cards standing. It's very difficult for people to get good information, and I try to give it to them, and I don't have anything depending on it. My thoughts may not be the best in the world, but they are fairly pure. So good luck to everybody.
Thank you, sir. Your efforts are appreciated here.
All right. Goodbye.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
John John Embry remains a precious metals industry professional insider for over three decades. He's accumulated experience as a portfolio manager and specialist since 1963, senior advisor at Sprott Asset Management, and a favorite and regular here on Gold Seek Radio. Welcome back, John Embry.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to chat with you.
This has just been one of the best years for the precious metals industry, and some folks are saying close to 40 years. I mean, that's the better part of your tenure. Still not many believers. You know, maybe it's the volatility that's scared some people away.
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, the whole sector was under enormous pressure after 2011. And you went through a, you know, a very difficult period when the gold price fell from 1900 to down around 1150, and silver fell even further, and the shares were annihilated. And this all sort of came to a head and ended at the beginning of this year at a time when gold and silver were remarkably cheap, and as were the shares. Now, we've had a, you know, a fairly significant rebound in gold and silver, but the shares did it, made a heroic leap. At one point, the Huey Gold Index, which is the most sort of inclusive of gold index, was up 180% since January the 19th. Now, there's been a correction here in the last few weeks, which, again, is maybe unnerving a few people, but I think it's a fantastic buying opportunity.
Obviously, the trend has changed. Even if we just back and fill for a few years, it still represents buying opportunities during every pullback. And actually, the XAU was up approximately 200% from its nadir, from the trough early in 2016. At one point, it was approaching 200%, and it's not even leveraged like the HUI, or as leveraged. So the greenback remains under pressure. Over the last few years, it's done nothing but tread water. It's had every opportunity to break out from the trading range to new highs. In fact, it's really one of the few currencies that's even yielding much of a return, somewhere around 0.5%, if you will, on the most basic level. And the Fed policymakers continue to jawbone hawkish comments. Very few people expect much more than maybe one more rate hike. How important is the dollar story, do you think, to gold, or investors even paying attention?
It's being promoted as being extremely important. And I mean, even though the dollar hasn't broken out, it's still been stronger than most other currencies. Like if you take the Canadian dollar, which where I live, I mean, the Canadian dollar has been materially weak against the U.S. dollar in the last couple of years with the problems in the oil business. So right now, I mean, the gold price in Canadian dollars isn't that far off its all-time high. And that's true in a lot of weak currency countries like Australia and South America and what have you. But I think when gold will really get going is when it sort of breaks out against the U.S. dollar. Because at that point, I think people realize that all the fiat currencies are flawed and that you'd better have some exposure in real money, which is gold and silver for that matter.
And the People's Bank of China obviously continue to stockpile large precious metals, at least on an accumulation basis. And, of course, the official numbers seem to indicate that the U.S. is at the top of the heap as far as gold stockpiles are concerned, or around, let's say, 10,000 tons, 8,000 to 10,000, depending on which source you cite. China is officially only around 3,000 tons, but some of our guests here have suggested that that number could be wildly underestimated. It could be a lowball figure. Our huge trading partner there, now the second largest economy in the world by some metrics, may have accumulated much larger precious metals reserves with no intention of parting with them or leasing them out as well. I mean, that's another key component there. Do you suspect that might be the case? And is that in anticipation of a new gold-backed reserve currency?
Well, I happen to agree with your people have been on your show that think they're understating their reserves. I think they put it in very different places. You know, they probably don't hold it in the Reserve Bank per se. But trust me, they have imported enormous quantities of gold into China over the last 10 years. And, you know, the fact is that nobody really knows what the gold holdings of the various central banks and treasuries around the world are. There are these reported numbers, but a lot of this stuff has been mobilized and it's been leased, and no one really knows what's in anybody's vault. But what you do know for sure is a lot of the eastern countries like Russia and China and India and what have you have been accumulating gold relentlessly for the last few years. And I think, as you said, that this is probably an anticipation of a change of the world's currency order. U.S. dollar, as you know, has been the reserve currency since the end of the Second World War. I don't think that's going to persist for that much longer, and I think a lot of these other nations realize that.
I think it's interesting you'd say that, because there's even one report from Coos Jansen that the Chinese banks, unlike ours here, who detest the barbarous relic, actually have massive gold holdings of their own. And it's ironic, because that was the original business model, was set up several hundred years ago in Great Britain. You held people's precious metals, okay, for the goldsmiths, and then you issued a piece of paper that said, I'm holding your gold, and maybe there's some interest, maybe there isn't. And that was the general idea in the big strong box. Okay, Bond King Bill Gross, they keep calling him the Bond King, but that's becoming less and less, I think, the case. He has lost his appetite for most bonds and suddenly is a gold bug, because this is a very financially savvy individual.
Well, Bill Gross is one of the leading bond guys in my lifetime. I mean, he is the king of bonds, really. But the fact is, he's dead right. I mean, he realizes as well as anybody what's going on here. The debasement of money that's going on and the ridiculously low interest rates available on any decent quality bond in the world. It's beyond my comprehension why anybody would own these things at this point. Furthest extreme, when you get into negative interest rates, I mean, I think when people look back on this era and writing books about it, they're going to be horrified at being up there with the guys that were in tulip mania and South Sea bubbles and everything.
We can just point fingers at who will be the next John Law, right, at our Fed policymakers.
True. The garbage that comes out of the various central bankers is enough to really sort of make you wonder.
Interesting story from Zero Hedge. Federal Reserve gold withdrawals from their bank vaults continues to reach record levels. It's accelerating almost 400 tons now since 2014. And, you know, I think that's emblematic of a situation where there's a loss in confidence in the safety, if you will, or at least the wherewithal and trustworthiness of our central bank, as well as a desire to secure national precious metal stockpiles by our trading partners. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I think, quite frankly, that you have your gold in the hands of someone else, and your counterparty is the least bit suspicious. I would recommend strongly you get your hands on your gold right away. And I think that is starting to, you know, happen at the official levels, at central bank levels. I mean, all this stuff that's sort of held in vaults for other people, it's being hypothecated and rehypothecated. Nobody knows who owns what now. So I can understand why people are asking for their gold back.
That is really, I think, going to be one of the key phrases that we hear thrown around at the next crisis, whenever that may be, next week, next month, next year. Rehypothecation, transparency, lack thereof. And, of course, where is the true value? Where is intrinsic value derived? I mean, I think people will just be speechless when they see what happens and what comes to pass. And you've really pointed that out well here on the show for many, many years. You've said, you know, and many of our guests, that precious metals in the hand, it's solid, it's real, cannot be rehypothecated. It's not perfect in every way, but it's as close as we've found in about 5,000 years of money.
Well, I tell you, like, so much of the gold that people hold today is in paper form. They have no idea what's behind the paper, and I would submit that there's so much paper gold that has little to no backing that when finally this sort of comes to a head, people are going to think they own gold. They're going to be settled for paper at the very time you don't want to own paper. So I'm a very great proponent. If you don't own it with physical in your possession, you better be real sure that the vehicle you own, the paper vehicle, has all the gold it, you know, it purports to have, and it's audited, and you're 100% confident that it's there.
You're also a huge proponent of silver, and that's the less well-known poor man's gold, the alternative that might just become a superstar in the event that the yellow metal becomes, frankly, hard to find. And there are growing signs of shortages in large scale, concerns by many top people on this show and other shows and other areas who seem to think that eventually the folks at the top, the very top of the pyramid, will have most of the yellow metal by the time this economic house of cards implodes. But the only thing left would be silver, which would make it perhaps return to a more historical gold-to-silver ratio. Can you give us the implications?
Well, I think what you just said is absolutely right. Why that silver, as you say, it's called poor man's gold. When gold sort of starts ascending to, you know, new highs, dramatic new highs, and it gets harder and harder to get. There's people that want some exposure. They won't even be able to afford gold, let alone if they even access it. So they'll turn to silver, which is a precious metal as well. One thing you can be sure of, in all previous real bull markets for gold and silver, the gold-silver ratio falls dramatically. I suspect it will fall dramatically again this time. So let's just say, for instance, gold went to $2,500, and the gold-silver ratio fell to 30. Well, I mean, it would go up twice as fast as the gold price went up. So you're looking at a $60, $70 price for silver. And that's just jacks for openers. So I think I would go so far as to say silver is one of the cheapest assets at this moment that I have ever seen in my career in any asset.
You know, the Bank of Ireland, they just announced in the Irish Times out of Dublin, charging for cash deposits. If you give us your money, we're going to charge you for that transaction. And of course, this is not news. I mean, there's negative rates around the world. In the short term, this may not have a huge impact on demand for the precious metals. But as confidence in the financial institutions begins to wane, people realize, wait a minute, you mean my money's not safe and I'm paying you for the privilege? That, to me, sounds like the aha wake-up moment where real money flows start to look for something solid and tangible.
You're absolutely right. Like, I mean, basically, one of the great arguments that the anti-gold camp has used forever is that it doesn't pay interest, gold. Well, guess what? If the other people have to pay to hold paper, I mean, that's just ludicrous. And I mean, that is the best advertisement I have ever heard for gold in my life.
Well said. All right, John Embree, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. I wonder if you could tell people more about Sprott Asset Management, perhaps help direct people's web browsers to any contact information.
I think they should just go to, you know, www.sprott.com, and we got a wealth of material available there on all sorts of subjects. It would be well worth their while.
John Embree, we always appreciate your thoughts, sir.
It's always nice to talk to you, Chris, anytime.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Back in April, I discussed a Bloomberg article that referenced how Deutsche Bank AG had settled a lawsuit over allegations it manipulated gold and silver prices, and how it agreed to help plaintiffs in the matter pursue similar claims against other banks as part of the settlements. In addition, the bank was going to turn over instant messages and other communications to help further the plaintiff's case. To date, nothing new has really appeared on that front. However, Deutsche Bank has again made the news this week by refusing to make delivery of physical gold. According to reports, Deutsche Bank was unable to satisfy a gold delivery request when asked to do so by a client of Germany's Zitra Gold Service. Many in the gold community are already speculating that this inability to make physical delivery marks the beginning of the end of the paper gold charade, where price discovery for real physical metal can finally occur. That may turn out to be the case, but it remains to be seen. Some have postulated that the settlement of Deutsche Bank's gold manipulation case in April would do nothing to curb other forms of gold manipulation, with naked shorting, algorithms, and bullion leasing, which is correct. But that settlement may have set the stage for other settlements with Deutsche Bank that it is currently involved with. A July 27th Bloomberg article discusses yet another settlement the bank is actively engaged in with the U.S. Department of Justice. This one involves a long-running investigation into its mortgage-backed securities business. According to the article, the bank is in talks concerning a potential settlement of claims that the DOJ may consider bringing based on its investigation of Deutsche Bank's residential mortgage-backed securities origination and securitization activities. Deutsche Bank is Germany's biggest bank and has paid more than $9 billion in fines and legal settlements worldwide since the start of 2008, according to data that Bloomberg has compiled. The settlements relate to violations of U.S. sanctions, rigging of interest rate benchmarks, and allegations it defrauded the U.S.-backed mortgage issuers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. No speculation was presented regarding what settlement terms could look like on this matter. The fact that significant multiple cases are in process against Deutsche Bank, including housing, will clearly help confuse the real cause and effect regarding any public acknowledgement, discussion, or debate about any consequences or market impairments that result from Deutsche Bank's involvement in these various manipulation schemes gone awry. Far better to be able to discuss impending market turmoil as it relates to Deutsche Bank in the context of housing manipulation as opposed to gold manipulation. For now, Deutsche Bank's housing settlement talks with the DOJ may be more important than this early blip on a fail to deliver from an already challenged bank located in a country that stores much of its physical gold abroad and is having a slow time in repatriating those reserves back to its own shores. This is one that bears close observation and monitoring, because housing and gold are two very volatile market segments, with lots of rapid changes built into the present equations for gold to go up and housing to once again correct. Stay alert, because the chessboard can change quickly. Chris, I'd like to direct our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and join my new email list. I've been gearing up for some time now to release new content and special features, which are soon to be just around the corner. So please direct your browser to conquerchange.com and sign up today. Updates are going to follow soon. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.